You think it's simple, huh?
No, no.
Well, it is simple. It's all that old thumb, see? Yeah. Now, some people do it like this. All wrong. Never get anywhere.
Oh, the poor thing.
Yeah, boy, but that old thumb never fails. You know, it's all a matter of how you do it, though. You know, now, you take number one, for instance. That's a short, jerky movement like this. That shows independence. You don't care whether it's top or not. You got money in your pocket, see?
Clever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but number two, that's a little wider movement. Smile goes with this one like this. That means you got a brand new story about the farmer's daughter.
Mm-mm. You figured that out all by yourself, huh?
Nah, that's nothing. Yeah, number three, that's a pip. Yeah, that's a pitiful one. You know, when you're broke and hungry and everything looks black? That's a long, sweeping movement like this. Got to follow through, though.
Oh, that's amazing.
Hmm. Yeah, but it's no good, though, if you haven't got a long face to go with it.
Here comes the car.
Okay, now watch me. I'm going to use number one. Keep your eye on that thumb, baby, and see what happens.
Got my eye on the thumb.
Something must have gone wrong. Oh. Try number two.
Mm. Well, when you get to 100, wake me up.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Awards Don't Matter, the podcast that looks at all the Best Picture winners and asks whether they still matter or not. My name is Andrew Pierce, and I'm joined by my co-host all the way from somewhere in the middle of America that's currently on fire.
Kentucky!
Yeah! Dave, welcome. Thank you very much for joining me again.
Yeah, it's good to be back. It's been a while since we've recorded, so it's been so long, and we'll talk about this at the end. It's been so long that I've changed my Twitter handle since the last time we recorded.
Goodness
so like every,
me.
So now everything we've done is totally out of date, so start here.
And it's not just because it's October that we're recording and it's horror season. I'm sure this is a permanent change that you're going to...
Yes. Yeah. The at has changed, not just the name, but the actual at. Big changes around here.
Yeah, new year, new you, everything.
That's right.
It's a new life. Congratulations.
That's right. I mean, it's 2020. What else am I doing? Like, yeah. Might as well mess around with this.
Right. On this particular episode, we're going to be talking about one of the bigger Best Picture winners, one of the most influential Best Picture winners around. It certainly helped create a whole genre and basically cement what it was to be a romantic comedy in American cinema. And that is Frank Capra's massive, big successful film, It Happened One Night. It is one of the films which won all five major Academy Awards, meaning it won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Adapted Screenplay, only matched by One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Silence of the Lambs. Pretty good brethren
Not rare. Bad. Yeah.
Not bad at all. And this film stars Claudette Colbert and Clark Gable as two people who just kind of bump into each other on a Greyhound bus from way down in Florida, heading all the way up to New York City, and romance ensues. Now, I before we discuss this film, I kind of want to talk about the show that you used to do, because this is right in the wheelhouse of a show that you used to do called The Grand Gesture.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So you're a bit of a, you know all about romantic comedies, don't you, Dave?
Yes, I'm an expert. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think romantic comedies sometimes get shoved into the corner of kind of like chick flicks. Only women like these movies, which is a lie. I love romantic comedies. I think there is, you know, it's certainly there are a lot of tropes within the genre. Of course, probably not back then when this came out because the genre didn't really exist. There were certainly romance. There were romances with comedy bits in them, but like a pure rom-com, like this feels like as I was watching this, we'll get into this later, but it feels like the start of something. Like as you're watching it, like it's very interesting. It's like magic. Like you're like, oh, wow, this is where all this came from. So yeah, actually, that show is still going on. I was actually just a guest on that show that I used to host. Great Gesture. But that show has totally changed. It's not about romantic comedies anymore. You know, the co-host Mike, who's also my co-host on another show, he just, you know, he's got to change stuff up. You just never know what he's going to do. So, you know, it's now... some connection to like Tim Burton's Batman. That's his grand gesture to his friend Derek. So they're going to compare everything to Batman for some reason. So when I was on, we covered The Abyss, We had a good time. You should check out that podcast, The Grand Gesture.
Nothing more romantic than water and men. So, I mean, as you're saying, like, it's the romantic comedy does get kind of treated like a bit of a terrible cousin of film in a way, and has been deemed to be the very female-centric genre, which is bullshit. It's absolute bullshit.
The thing that's extra crazy about it is, like, okay, these are date movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Men go on dates with all these women. Yeah. Like, so clearly, and we just, like, a lot of guys are like, no, I hate that shit. I don't watch that. And then you sit down with your partner and you're like, oh, this is nice. Don't lie. You love it.
Yeah. And you should as well. Like, this is a foundational part of cinema, and it is certainly less frequent in the last 10, 15 years or so. I guess the romantic comedy genre is kind of taken a backseat.
They're all on Netflix.
Oh, they're all on Netflix,
The new home for romantic comedies, because they're, frankly, because they're really cheap to make, and they feel like, disposable's the wrong word, but they're just kind of, like, nice, and like, okay, I don't have to think too hard about this, we can all relate to it, so it's kind of perfect for the Netflix model, where you can just, you know, put on To All the Boys I've Loved Before, or, you know, Always Be My Maybe. Like, these are all, like, and it is a little bit sad to me, Mike and I have talked about this on that show, that, like, 20 years ago, those movies would have made crazy, crazy money. Like, Meg Ryan movies made bank. Like, she was a box office star. And the world changed. And now we got, you know, men spandex instead of romantic comedies. And I think, honestly, we're the worst for it. So watch more romantic comedies.
Yeah.
If we ever have movies in the theater again.
Yeah, and we have to manufacture relationships in those films as well in our mind, and say, you know, this person shipping people here and there, and saying, oh, they're in love with this person.
Or canon tells us that they are actually together, so...
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is that, you know, that It Happened One Night shows is that it's actually mighty hard to have great chemistry in these kinds of films, and great... beautiful, wonderful dialogue. This is such a dialogue-rich film, and so much so that it just kind of... It threw me for a six to start off with, because the first 10, 15 minutes, it just kind of throws you into the mix of what's going on, which is, you know, Ellie, who's played by Claudette Colbert, is a very, very young, spoiled, rich daughter of a man named... Alexander Andrews, and he is he's played by Walter Connolly, and as we see at the beginning, he is keeping her captive on a boat out in the middle of somewhere off Florida.
As one does. Good and parenting. Fine.
My initial reaction to this was like, oh, all right, this film's got a lot of ground to make up for what's happening right now in this moment to make this feel A-okay. And sure enough, you know, there is a reason why he's keeping her trapped on this boat, and it's to stop her getting married to a pilot named King Wesley, played by Jameson Thomas, who is barely in the film and is a bit of a wet rag of a man, and she does want to rush off to New York to come be with this beau, and every time that we do see him, we think, why? And especially as an opposed to the man who she meets on a bus heading again to New York City, which is Peter Warne, played by Clark Gable, who is one of the most suave and charismatic men around, and gosh, he looks good in this film. It is a delight to watch him perform and play and just tease the dialogue and play around with it, and tease Claudette Colbert as well. They have wonderful chemistry in this film, which is a huge thing, because they are at each other's necks for a lot of the way. And you know, in an interesting way, like, one of the other films we're going to be discussing in a future episode is The Thin Man, and the relationship in that film is very similar to the relationship here, in a very polite jab kind of way. Yes. How did you see that kind of relationship? The sparring, touching sparring, I guess, is the way of putting it.
So a couple things. One, like, I was watching this and, like, I just kind of had this, you know, I talked about this, like, feels like magic, like seeing this genre, like, appear in time before your eyes. And I was like, as they, you know, ran into each other on this, on this bus. I'm like, it's a meet cute. Like, this is the meet cute. This is the beginning of the meet cute, like where they just immediately connect. And like, you know, there's that verbal sparring, but you can tell there's a spark there immediately. And I was just like, this is so cool.
Excuse me, lady, but that upon which you sit is mine.
I beg your pardon.
Now listen, I put up a stiff fight for that seat. So if it's just the same to you, scram.
Driver, are these seats reserved?
No, first come, first served.
Thank you.
Hey, driver, these seats accommodate two people, don't they?
Well, maybe they do and maybe they don't.
Thank you.
Move over. This is a maybe they do.
If you'd ask me real nice, I might put that bag up there for you. Next time you drop in, bring your folks.
And I love the fact that it just throws you in with it. Like, they basically tell you the plot in the first 5 minutes. Like, here's her deal. Here's why she's kept on this boat. All right, let's go. Let's have these two people meet. They don't waste a bunch of time. You don't have a lot of background on him to start. Like, you kind of find out what he does for a living, and that's it, right? And then these two are thrown together. And you mentioned chemistry, and I can't imagine how difficult it must be to be a director or a casting director. Because that's your job, right? Is to listen to them read, you know, have them play off each other and go like, yeah, they've got it. But within like, I would say it takes about 20 seconds and you're like, oh my God, these two, like, just get a room already. Like, you just know it from the very, very start. And it's also a tough sell in 2020 because of that verbal sparring can teeter on that edge of misogyny, right? You got to be real careful with it. But I think that she stands up for herself at numerous points during the movie, and you know that she can take care of herself. And he is, as you said, so suave, so debonair, so just so cool, man, that like all that stuff kind of goes out the window. And you're just like rooting. You're not even necessarily just rooting for them to end up together. You're like rooting for this just to keep going. Like, I could just let's be in a room with these two and have them talk for like 100 minutes. Like, I'm good with that. And, you know, again, the chemistry is so important because this movie especially, is there even a scene without these two in it? Like, maybe at the very beginning when they're setting up everything, but for the rest of the movie, it's Claudette Colbert and him together. And so if that doesn't work, oh boy, you are in trouble.
The scene that kind of sticks out to me in that regard, near the end of the film, when the two are separated and she is rushing off to go and get married to King Wesley, and there is a moment of her in a dress talking to her father, and you can just see the life kind of having drained out of her. You know, she thought that the guy that she had fallen in love with has abandoned her, when in reality he has gone to go and try and secure her love and her relationship and her marriage and all this kind of stuff. It's, you know, again, as you're saying, the tropes didn't really exist then. And this is kind of the foundation of so many different tropes. The bride running away at the wedding, the flashing of the leg to elicit a whole bunch of cheers from the men in the crowd and stuff like that, and get cars pulling over and all this kind of stuff.
I don't think I'll write that book after all.
Yeah, think of all the fun you had, though. Do you mind if I try?
You. Don't make me laugh.
Oh, you're such a smart aleck. Nobody knows anything but you. I'll stop a car and I won't use my thumb.
What are you going to do?
It's a system all my own.
And she's got a great leg, man. That scene, she does. There is a reason. There is a reason that is known. There is a reason it is shown on every single Oscars telecast where they have this compilation of great cinema moments. Like, man, it works. It still works. Like, I was just like, I was worried about that as I sat down to watch this, because that is so known. Sometimes when a sequence is so known, you're like, ah, who cares? Or the movie around it actually isn't that good. But I'm just going to, like, ruin the suspense here. The movie is that good. Like, that scene, like, honestly, you could take that scene out, and this is still a great movie. And it's also the type of movie that, like, man, I wish awards would award movies like this more often. Like, if you made this exact movie now and it was wildly successful, it doesn't get nominated for anything. Not a damn thing. Because, again, we denigrate, I mean, in general, the culture, the film culture denigrates women, and these are seen as women's pictures. So there's no way this gets nominated. But I'm like, this makes me so happy, like, looking back, like, oh, thank God that this won. Because, Andrew, I watched a few of the movies that were nominated. So I watched about 25 minutes of The Barretts of Wimpole Street and was about to fall asleep, so I just let that go. Cleopatra was also nominated, the original Cleopatra, the Cecil B. DeMille movie, and that's pretty good. But then there's stuff like The House of Rothschild and Imitation of Life. So House of Rothschild is about this, like, powerful Jewish family, right? You know, as the patriarch of the family is dying poor and penniless, he basically tells his sons to go out and conquer the world, and here's how you do it. And it's essentially like you do it with money. So it becomes very, like, Jewish stereotypical. Like, they make him and this family the hero, but it still comes off a little like money grubbing, penny pinching Jews. And I'm like, ooh, I don't like this at all. And Imitation of Life, which you've seen, Andrew, is one of those movies that, and Hollywood does this about every 10 or 20 years, where they're like, we're going to make a movie about race. And yeah, we solved it. We did a good job with that one. Like, it just, you know, it happened with Crash. It happened with Green Book. This is like, you know, this year's version of Green Book, where it's like very much like, we're going to solve this problem. And then you look closer and you're like, oh, that's really racist. Like, I think, like, I mean, there's that reaction already for something like Green Book, but I bet in 50 years, if someone were to go back and they're going to watch Green Book and they're going to be like, this won awards? What is going on? What was going on in the late 2010s that people thought this was great? So what I'm saying is, like, I, you know, there was like 11 or 12 movies nominated. I think I watched 5 or 6 of them, just because, one, because of time, and two, because there's some movies, they're just hard to track down from this era. But this is by far, not by far, because The Thin Man exists, but those two, like, kind of outshine everything else that came out that year. Like, Cleopatra's good, but it's, like, a very, you know, it's a big-budget spectacle, and it's, like, it's interesting because it's, like, a very serious movie, and it's, like, it's accidentally funny. And if they had just, like, leaned into the comedy, I think it's a better movie. But, like, I look at this group, and I'm like, yeah, okay, you guys picked the right one. And it's a movie that still holds up today. So it's so impressive. Because anytime you get, you know, more than 15, 20 years from the present, you're always a little worried, like, okay, we'll see how this holds up. Because we're racist now, but people were really racist back then. And misogynist and all that. And I think this one just, it balances so well. Like, there are moments that are quote-unquote problematic, for sure. But it's so, it does it with a wink. You know, it's never cruel. And I think that is what sets it apart. There's a lot of movies with, like, kind of the man taming, you know, the wild young woman. And it's very like, oh, I'm going to throw her in the pool. I'm going to do that, you know. And this never has those moments. Like, it just, it absolutely works. Like, I think one of my favorite scenes is when they're, like, sharing a room together, and they have kind of this wall up between them, and they kind of have to play act as if they were together. And the whole time you're just like, you guys aren't play acting anymore. Like, this is real. And actually, for once, especially during this period of time, she is not the one who is sexualized. He is. He does, like, a striptease. He does, like, you know, he slowly undresses for her. And this is what you do until she blinks. And it's just like, nope, that's enough of that. But he was ready to just go all out. And I was like, you don't even see that now.
Perhaps you're interested in how a man undresses. You know, there's a funny thing about that. Quite a study in psychology. No two men do it alike. You know, I once knew a man who kept his hat on until he was completely undressed. Yeah, now he made a picture. Years later, his secret came out. He wore a toupee. Yeah. You know, I have a method all my own. If you'll notice, the coat came first, then the tie, then the shirt.
Now, according to Hoyle, after that, the pants should be next. Here's where I'm different. I go for the shoes next. First the right, then the left. After that, it's every man for himself.
No, not at all. I found it interesting to know that she didn't want to get undressed on screen, which is why he gets undressed, because it's much easier.
Somebody's getting naked, goddammit. Brent Capra's
somebody's
like,
getting naked. Yeah.
Somebody's taking their clothes off. I don't care which one of you it is.
Yeah. And so usually men of that era as well would be wearing undershirts, and Clark Gable wasn't wearing an undershirt, mostly because he is giving this wonderful dialogue about everything and his modesty and not wanting to get undressed in front of her and all this kind of stuff, and how he has all of these ideas and stuff. And so he's running this wonderful dialogue there. And of course, it was kind of, it would have been too hard to have run the dialogue and take off an undershirt and a top shirt as well. So they're like, let's just not have you wearing an undershirt and just have you wearing a top shirt, and that would be much easier because he can unbutton it. And so it makes it flow much easier. And there is a bit of a myth in the sense that people have talked about how the sales of undershirts dropped at this period of time because of this film. Whether that's true or not, who knows? But it sounds great.
Andrew, I need that to be true. That makes me happy if that's true. Like, that's great. The two of them together. Like, you know, sometimes actors in these types of movies, it takes a while for you to warm up to them individually. But, like, both of them, like, as soon as they show up, I'm like, I'm into this. Like, just, you know, and I can't imagine how cool and amazing this was when this was released. Because, like, those tropes didn't exist. So this must have felt like, I mean, not to, like, go too all out, but this is kind of revolutionary when it comes to film. Like, this is a moment. And I think you can feel it now. And I'm sure back then it was like, oh my God, what am I watching? And of course it was a runaway success. Like, it made so much money and won all these awards. And, like, honestly, I'm not mad about any of those wins because everyone in this is really good.
But the interesting thing is that at the time, Colbert had said that she, at the end of production, she said, I just finished the worst picture in the world. And it took a long time. It got positive reviews as it came out of the gate, but it took a long time for it to actually make money before it hit the secondary movie houses and stuff like that. It took a while before it really, really hit on and became a success. And that's the thing, is that in the moment, these kinds of films may not feel revolutionary. They may not feel like a moment. But it's not until that they've got time to sit with people and to grow with people and to make people feel comfortable, that they kind of succeed. And another thing which I heard about was that tickets of Greyhound tickets and driving on buses and stuff like that increased because people are like, oh, I didn't realize I could actually go and see the rest of America via bus and stuff.
They weren't just like, I gotta meet my Claudette Colbert. I gotta meet my Clark Gable. I'm gonna get a bus ticket, man. You just never know who's gonna steal your seat. This is your shot.
One of the things which I find really interesting as well is how they managed to organically put in her naivety about wealth and about poverty in the film. There's a certain point where they're riding on the bus and they stop for a period of time, and she hops off and has to go somewhere, and she says to Clark Gable, you know, I'll be back a little bit late. And he's like, well, the bus isn't going to wait for you. They're just going to leave. And she's like, oh, they'll wait. You know, and she tells the person at the counter, like, I'll be 20 minutes late, and just nicks off and does her thing and then comes back. And the bus is gone, of course. And she's like, why didn't they wait? I told them that I was going to be 20 minutes late. And it's like, no, these guys are running on a schedule. They've got to, you know. And her lack of awareness about the reality of the world is both. It's never, I think one of the most impressive things is it's never a bad point about her character. It actually highlights how sad it is that she has been kept in behind, I guess, well, one of the terms that they continually use is the walls of Jericho, in a way, where she is, you know, protected by this wealth, protected by society and stuff. And I think that kind of makes it a little bit it brings the wealthy down to the level of the people who lived through a Great Depression and who were still living in, you know, the midst of poverty and stuff like that. And I think for me, at least watching this in 2020, like, this still feels fresh and immediate right now. It feels still relevant right now, and not in a sense that it's like, wow, everything that they're saying is like, there is so little you need to do to this film to make it modern and to translate it for a modern audience. And that is it's a perfect sign of a timeless film. It just really works. It's just wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you bring up this idea of her being like maybe not so aware of the realities of life, right? Because she has been spoiled for her entire life. And that could go sour so easily. That could make an audience turn on a character like this woman. She doesn't even know what a bus is. Like, are you kidding me right now? Yeah. But I think because she is so interpersonally sharp, I think it gets forgiven. Right? Because in the very beginning, and honestly, we have to mention the great scene between Clark Gable and the, you know, whoever the guy is on the bus, the oh yeah scene, which also feels very modern. Like, I was watching this, you know, like Clark Gable, every time this guy says, oh yeah, well, like, well, why didn't you say that to begin with? If I'd have known, oh yeah. Like, it's very funny, like, and very sharp and bounces back and forth. And he is clearly above this guy as far as wits, like, and he knows it, right? And he's never trying to be extra cruel to him. Like, he's trying to like get his little jabs in, but he's not out to get him. He's just like, man, I'm just trying to get on this bus. Will you just let me do my thing here? But then the back and forth between him and Claudette Colbert, like, she wins that particular joust, right? Between them. And just by saying, like, are these assigned seats? Damn it.
Like, that's through like a knife. Okay. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Just with one line. And it's like, because she is so on her toes and is able to match wits with Clark freaking Gable, then you forgive a lot. You forgive that she doesn't know that buses run on a schedule. And I think you also forgive it because Clark Gable's character forgives it. Like, he's like entertained by this, and not in a way where he's mocking her, but just like, oh, wow, you don't get this. Let me help you out here and tell you how this is going to work, okay? You know, and even the scene where he goes off and, like, chases after the guy that stole her suitcase, which is a very honorable, nice, kind thing to do. And he gets back and she has no idea. Like, why is this fool running around? Like, why are you out of breath? And then she, of course, after that, she realizes it. And he has this look on his face like, he's, like, kind of in awe of her. Like,
How did you miss this?
Not only how did you miss this, like, how have you survived? How are you walking and talking at the same time? Like, how did you not see that? You know, because she's just unaware, because she's never had to be, you know? So I think a lot of that gets brushed aside. But again, this is a fine dance that, like, if there's errors on either side, I think the audience completely turns on this character, you know?
I think one of the things which I really like about that is he elevates her up in a way that is highlighted by characters like Oscar Shapley, who is, I rewatched one of my favorite films, Some Like It Hot, which came out, you know, 20 years after this.
Hey, I just bought that. That's coming in the mail in like 2 days.
It's a brilliant film. I love that movie. It's such an easy film to watch. But there are so many characters in that film, this film, and, you know, so many other films as well, of these men who talk about themselves like in the third person. And Oscar Shapley is a man who tries to pick up Ellie in the bus, and he has a wife and kids and he travels around on buses, and, you know, he's a traveling businessman in a way, and is just kind of domineering and is like, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And he says it in a way that is like supposed to be endearing, but it's also kind of very manipulative.
Yes.
And Peter Warne as a character counteracts those kinds of male figures in a way that doesn't meet Ellie and the other women on the same level. It's not still 100% respectful and, you know, saying, you know, you are equal to me, but it is very much like a, you're not equal, but you don't deserve to be treated like that. And I think that, you know, that's one of the smart things about this particular film, is that they set in those tones of, you know, Well, at least Peter's not this kind of obnoxious man who is just like seeing a woman walking on the street and going, I'm going to take her. And, you know, we saw it in one of the best Broadway, best picture winners ever, The Broadway Melody, where,
ooh,
you know, the men would just be like walking around going, well, I'm just going to take this woman. And the woman has no choice whatsoever. And I think that this kind of film helps deconstruct that a little bit. It doesn't completely change the whole trope or the format, but it certainly challenges it. And that's really comforting and refreshing to see, because as so often with these particular films in the early era, and sadly in today's day and age as well, women aren't really given the best footing in the film. They're not really given the best character to work with to create somebody who is themselves. And in every step of the way in this particular film, you feel like this is somebody who can, you know, be herself by the end of the film. Yes, she's got Peter by her side, but she feels free. She talks about wanting to, you know, living the life of a poor person. She's like, this sounds like nothing better than doing that. Like, that sounds like a dream, because at least I would have something to do. And that's what I find is so wonderful about this, is she feels alive. And it's lovely. Yeah.
And so she has an actual arc. She changes in the best possible way. And, you know, I think, you know, what you brought up, this like comparison between our lead male character and like these other like monsters that are out there. It's like at this point, it's an old trick, but it still works. Right. You can have a lead male character with faults as long as you have other male characters in the movie where you're like, well, at least it's not that fucking guy. Like, Jesus, that guy's awful. So by comparison, Clark Gable looks even more charming, and God knows the man does not need help in that department, because he just like oozes charm like from the moment he gets on the screen. And honestly, I would watch an entire movie of Clark Gable pretending to be in the mafia. Like, yeah. I would watch that. That sequence is fantastic. And like, again, you mentioned the writing a couple times, but it's like, it's again a really difficult balance, because when a movie is like so well written, sometimes you're like, okay, now this doesn't sound like people anymore. You know, I think someone like Aaron Sorkin falls into that. Like, he falls in love with the language so much, and you look at the language and you're like, wow, this is great. This is really well written. Then you look like no human being has ever said those words strung together. Like, that doesn't happen. You know, same thing with even someone like Kevin Smith, all his characters speak in monologues, right? And it's like, no, people don't really talk like that. But this hits that sweet spot where it's super well-written, super charming, and yet you're like, but I believe it. I believe these two characters. And more importantly, I believe that these two characters are falling for one another. And that romance really, really works. I was also surprised at, like, because, like, as the movie was almost wrapping up, like, I looked at the time left, and it's like 2 minutes left. And, like, the way the movie wraps up, it's just like, whoop, okay, we're done. Like,
yep.
it does, like, I almost wanted, like, a little bit more at the end there, like, maybe 5 minutes of more. But it all still works so well that it's, like, any complaints I have about this movie are just nitpicks. Like, they're just like, well, it's, like, tweak this little thing. Like, it's like, this is a great movie. Like, it's just, sometimes the Academy Awards somehow gets it right. And I think this is an example of them getting it right.
It is, yeah. Although, as you're saying, like, the competition didn't sound that that crash hot this year. But you know, it's one of the benefits, at least for this particular film, is that it doesn't feel like it won by default. Like,
yes.
Okay.
I mean, you could put this in many other years, and I'd still be like, yeah, that's worthy for sure.
Yeah. One of the things I find interesting,
certainly better
than
Cimarron. I'm just saying.
Oh yeah. Look, it is, yes, but, you know, I don't think I'm going to be able to live that one down.
Never.
One of the things which I like about this film as well is it is a pre-code film, so they are given a little bit of freedom to have that kind of sexual energy and to have sexual references as well, and not explicit, but they do hide it in ways which is just absolutely wonderful. And in that final shot, as you're saying, this film wraps up, but it's set up these aspects of it so brilliantly throughout the whole entire film. You know, as they sleep in different rooms throughout the film, he puts up a curtain of a blanket in between their beds, and at the end, you know, and he's this beautiful moment where he's gotten somebody to go and purchase a trumpet just so they can play you know, this trumpet call as the walls of Jericho fall, and all you see is just this blanket fall, and you're like, they're about to get it on, and it's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful, and it's just so simple as well, how effective the language of cinema is used here. This is an absolute delight, and yes, I agree with you as well in the sense that, you know, why can't we have these kinds of films celebrated more? I remember when, you know, while Crazy Rich Asians isn't of the same format as such, and it's not as the same at the same caliber
or of the same quality. Yeah,
I like the film. It's a nice, three and a half star film,
but it's not. Yeah. It happened one night. What is?
No, it's not. But I do remember at the time when it came out that people were like, "Hey, maybe this film should get nominated for Best Picture and, you know, screenplay and acting and stuff like that." And there were talks about Constance Wu in the talks for Best Actress and everything. And it's like, I remember the anger and the frustration attacking that particular film just because people are like, this is really good. Maybe we should consider it for some awards. And people are like, how dare you? This is just a romantic comedy. It shouldn't be in the same breath as Moonlight and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, sure, it's no Moonlight, it's no Shape of Water, but on the same hand, these films have a meaning, have a purpose. They are great for a reason. And arguably as well, when people are reaching for something to watch, a comfort film of some hand, you know, they're going for Sleepless in Seattle. They're going for When Harry Met Sally. They're going for It Happened One Night. And if anything, these are one of the most important aspects of genres of cinema as a whole. And I'm glad that this film at least won. And I know that eventually we'll be talking about Annie Hall, which is also a romantic comedy. And that is a very stylized thing. When you're talking about Kevin Smith and Aaron Sorkin and stuff like that, Woody Allen's dialogue is equally so, you know, nobody has ever said that in your life except for Woody Allen.
Yes.
But yeah, I just wish that there were more of these littered throughout the Best Picture winners and more of these littered through Oscar history, because they deserve celebration. They are a foundational aspect of cinema, and they are one of the most comfortable films to watch. And It Happened One Night is a, you know, a template for this kind of film. What were you going to say?
So as you were talking, and unbelievably, I was listening for once.
No way.
It made me think of something. So, well, first of all, friend of the pod, Michael Dennison, will be very angry that you did not mention You've Got Mail in the comfort food that you went to.
I said Sleepless in Seattle. Yeah. It's better than You've Got Mail.
Okay. Hey, look, I am staying out of that fight because that's going to be a bare knuckle brawl between the two of you. You guys have strong opinions about those movies. I happen to like them both. I think they're both very pleasant and wonderful. So I'm staying out of that one. But what I was thinking is, you know, you talked about Crazy Rich Asians and people getting very weirdly upset about it. And so obviously I love Oscar movies. That's why I agreed to do this podcast with you. But you know what I fucking hate? People will talk about the Oscars on Twitter or elsewhere. And here is why. This is a perfect example, is that people in that field cannot stand a surprise. They cannot stand a movie that people just enjoy getting a nomination. I'm sure, you know, if like, you know, movies like The Dark Knight, you know, get nominated, they lose their frigging minds. And I think a big part of it is there is a whole terrifying industry behind the Oscars now. Not just the Oscars itself, but so much writing, so much podcasting, so much everything around the Oscars. And a big piece of that is these film festivals, right? In order to get even thought about for an Oscar, like if you're not at Sundance, if you're not at, you know, fill in the blank, whatever festival you want to talk about, if you're not there, then you don't matter, right? If you're not at Cannes, whatever it is. And so if you didn't have your debut, you know, 9 months before the normal people can see it, then nobody gives a shit. So when a movie comes out and does that well and people start talking about it and it gets that buzz, people in that field or people who want to be in that field get really upset about it. And I'm like, can't you just like, I don't know, man, like watch a movie and enjoy it? And like, that's okay. It doesn't have to be. And I love, you know, movies that are sad, right? I'm not against that. You know, I'm not against bittersweet films at all. Some of my favorite films fall into those categories. But there's nothing wrong with just watching a movie and like it putting a freaking smile on your face. That's okay. It doesn't have to be Oscar bait. It doesn't have to be Oscar caliber. Like, a movie like Crazy Rich Asians, whether you like it or not, it does exactly what it sets out to do. And that's, like, at best 1% of movies that come out that actually succeed at what they're trying to do, whatever it may be. Some movies are trying to make you smile. Some movies are trying to make you cry. Some movies are trying to make you think. Crazy Rich Asians is trying to make you feel that feeling of romance and happiness by the end. Does it? Like, sorry, it's not, you know, not to, like, talk shit about myself. Sorry, it's not Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Sorry, it's not in French. Sorry, it's not,
I like how you picked a film that wasn't even nominated for anything.
It should have been.
It should have been, yeah.
You know, or Moonlight, you know, like, take your pick. You know, movies like that feel like, okay, these are Oscar-type movies. And I think there's room for more. Like, I complained about them nominating so many movies because I'm trying to watch all of them. But I would love if every year for the Oscars, 15 movies got nominated. Because, like, okay, that movie's probably not going to win, but look, it's getting a little bit of a bump, right? And when we had movies in theaters in America, they would have those, like, you know, we're re-releasing it for the Oscar season. And movies like that would get noticed, and more eyes would get to them. Because I know people that watch, like, 3 movies a year, but then when the Oscar nominations come out, they make it a point to see those movies. So these nominations do end up mattering. And it's like, it doesn't just have to be so freaking sad and so deep. It can be, it happened one night in The Thin Man. Like, that is a great, like, I actually did watch this as a double feature. I watched them back to back.
And it was a double feature.
Yeah. It was great. I had a great time. Like, I was just like, you know, I had to go to work the next day and I wasn't like, ugh, I wasn't feeling too great about work. And I just put these on and I was like, you know what? That was a great 3.5-4 hours. Like, I really had a good time tonight. And I didn't have anybody over. I didn't need to talk to anybody. I just put on these 2 movies and it immediately put me in a good mood. And there's nothing wrong with a movie that entertains you, that makes you happy. That's okay. And that's what this year was.
Yeah, and I think as we progress through these films, we are going to critique what it means to be a Oscar-winning film, what it means to be an Oscar film, because
it's good,
certainly
it'll be
from
interesting to see how that changes over time from like the 1930s to like the 2010s. There's going to be some differences.
I think in the 80s, the 70s, and 80s, having a look forward, it feels like that's the real period that the serious film kind of cemented place, and where you've got your Rain Mans and...
Can I blame Ordinary People for this? I know it's one of your favorite movies.
But that is an atypical Oscar film. Like, it is, that has Oscar written all over it. And it is a, you know, it's frustrating because, yeah, I do want those kinds of fun films to be recognized and win as well. But yeah, let's end up with the question, which we always ask, which is whether It Happened One Night is still important. What does it still matter nowadays? Is
yes!
it a vital film?
Yes!
Of course it is. Yeah,
of course it does. It changed the game, man. This is, like, I mean, I called it revolutionary, so I guess, yeah, it matters. Like, it not only created a new genre, but, like, this is so rare, too. Like, it perfected the genre when it started it. Like, this is, a lot of times, like, you look at, like, the original action movies, right? Which are kind of the gangster movies, right? Of the 1920s, 1930s. And you're like, okay, if that came out now just like that, we would laugh at it. Like, I could see where it was going and it's headed to really cool places. But like you mentioned at the beginning of this episode, you could make like 2 or 3 small changes to this movie and it feels like now. Like, there's not that much you have to change. And absolutely it matters. I just wish it mattered more to the Academy. I wish movies like this actually mattered to them, because like we need some light stuff too, you know? Sweet with the sour, happy with the sad, light with the heavy. Give me more of It Happened One Night.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And certainly in the year, like the time that we're currently in and stuff like that, I think that while I do love a good sad film, I love a good drama, and you know, a film that comments on the age that we live in is really important. But I tell you what, they're a dime a dozen. You know, they're everywhere. Like, it feels
God,
like every single film
all
nowadays.
The time. Jesus Christ.
And And to be fair, like, there is a real reality of a lot of them needing to have more diversity, more people of color, more queer people, more queer stories and stuff like that. And with that, there does come a lot of social awareness. You know, this is the life of what it means to be a trans person in 2020, that kind of thing. And they are important. I'm not trying to belittle them. But on the same hand, that feels like every single film. And so I do wish that there was something just a little bit refreshing, something a little bit lighter that gets celebrated and elevated. And, you know, maybe I haven't seen it yet because it's not come out in Australia, but one of the films that is kind of being talked about for next year is Palm Springs, the Andy Samberg film, which, you know, won't go into that right now, but it's like, that feels like a refreshing kind of film in a lot of ways. And yeah, I'm just echoing what we've already said. So, yeah, this is a really important
Here's what I'll say. This is my final out of the, eight movies that we've watched for this podcast already?
Yep.
This is number one. This is the best one. That's how strongly I feel about this. This is just above a movie that we both love. So this is how – I think it's great. Like, I think it's absolutely fantastic, and everyone should watch it. And I mean everyone. That's the thing. So a movie like Sunrise, which is great, like, fantastic, and, you know, bridges that gap right when, you know, talkies were first happening. So it's a very different kind of movie. It's not a movie I would recommend to everybody, right? It's not, you know, there's certain people who are like, oh, you'll really like this. But, like, I'm not going to, you know –
Educate the Philistines, Dave. Make them watch
it. I'm not going to, like, go to my coworkers and be like, check out this silent film. Yeah, it's really good. But, like, it happened one night. I could recommend to anybody. Absolutely anybody. And be pretty confident they'd enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
It's great. It's great.
Well, I won't spoil. I won't say what my ranking is, but it's currently sitting right alongside another film with a strapping young man. Yancey Cravat. Anyway, where did people find you online, Dave? What's your Twitter handle?
That changed now. Actually, I mentioned my co-host Mike a couple times. He chose the name for me because I am bereft of ideas. And it's Darn That Dave, which I think is perfect for my the way I interact on Twitter, because most people have that reaction to me. So follow me at Darn That Dave. And of course, follow our podcast. What is it? Awards Don't Pod?
Yeah, that's it. I haven't tweeted from there in a little bit, but Awards Don't Matter Pod is where you can find us on Twitter. Give us a listen and all that kind of stuff. Share us and everything. There has been a lot of listeners for this little podcast, which has been really nice. We've, you know, not done push out that many episodes, but we're already racked up 1,000 listens, which is
wow. Thank you for listening. That's exciting. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had like 1,000 people listen to anything I've ever done before. So it's really nice. And I appreciate you muting the Australian and just listening to the American. Look, all that matters is the
as you should. As you should. You know he likes that nonsense, that Western nonsense, like Cimarron. Good. Exactly.
Damn straight. I'll champion films that need to be
celebrated. At least you didn't like the Broadway Melody. I'll give you that. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So on the next episode, we are continuing a bit of a look at some of the other films that have been nominated for Best Picture and asking whether they matter still or not. And there is a particular film which we've referenced a few times in this episode, which is The Thin Man. And as we talk about that film in the next episode, you'll understand why we select this particular one, because it is a, just like It Happened One Night, it is a genre-defining film. It is a creator of a lot of things and has influences far-reaching to modern day. Give us a listen on the next episode of that, which is The Thin Man. And as Dave says, make sure to watch It Happened One Night. You will love it. It is an absolute treat. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you all on the next episode of Awards Don't Matter.
Detectives. Oh, that's Father at work. Peter, what will I do? Maybe I can jump out of the window. They won't see me.
Here, sit down. Get your eyes in there. Get your eyes in here. Yeah, I got a letter from Aunt Bella last week. She says if we don't stop over in Wilkes-Barre, she'll never forgive us.
What are you talking about?
The baby's due next month. They want us to come. She saw your sister on the street the other day. She says she's looking swell.
Come in.
You know, I hope Aunt Bella has a boy, don't you? Grandma says it's going to be a girl, though, and she hasn't missed calling one in years.
May I'm here to see your sweetheart?
Who, me? You want to see me?
What's your name?
Are you addressing me?
Yeah, what's your name?
Hey, wait a minute. That's my wife you're talking to. What do you mean, coming here? What do you want, anyway?
We're looking for somebody.
Yeah, well, look your head off, but don't come busting in here. This isn't a public park. I got nerves to take a sock at you.
Take it easy, son. Take it easy.
These men are detectives, Mr. Moore.
I don't care if they're the whole police department. They can't come busting in here shooting questions of my wife.
Now, don't get so excited, Peter. The men just ask you a civil question.
Oh, is that so? Say, how many times have I told you to stop butting in when I'm having an argument?
Well, you don't have to lose your temper.
You don't have to lose your temper.
That's what they said the other time, too. Every time I tried to protect you. The other night at the Elks dance, when that big Swede made a pass at you.
He didn't make a pass at me. I told you a million times.
Oh, no, I saw him. Kept pawing you all over the dance floor.
He didn't. You were drunk.
Ah, nuts. You're just like your old man. Once a plumber's daughter, always a plumber's daughter. Then an ounce of brains in your whole family.
Oh, Peter, what you've got for them, I won't feel you.
Ah, shut up.
Well, you see what you've done?
Sorry, Mr. Warren, but you see, we've got to check up on everybody.
We're looking for a girl by the name of Ellen Andrews. You know, the daughter of that big Wall Street mob.
Yeah, well, it's too bad you're looking for a plumber's daughter. Quick, baller! Quick, baller!
I told you that.